You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Now, I have no idea if Ron Reyes likes the Rolling Stones. He can tell us about that. But it is Vietnam shit, all right? And so you got to play Vietnam music. And this song made famous in the movie Apocalypse Now in a water skiing scene. It's an awesome song. The Spider Monkey himself out front dancing. And joining me again is Ron Reyes. So, Ron, first of all, how you doing?
Great, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. Now, just so everybody knows, we have to reintroduce you to everybody, Ron, in case they didn't hear the first segment we did. But Ron is a Gold Star son. And so, Ron, you got to give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of I don't even know how our paths crossed. I must have seen something written about you in an article on the Internet, yes?
No, actually, you and I, it was at... I can't think of his last name. Ken's funeral.
Ken Pipes' funeral.
That's
shit.
It. Shit. Yeah, Pipes, Skipper's funeral. And then we were connected there, crossed paths, and we had a great conversation, and that's how we crossed paths the first time, and then you had me on, and I told my story. And, you know, here we are.
So your father's killed in the mountain battles around Khe Sanh. He's a member of 1st Battalion, 9th Marines?
Yes, correct.
Bravo Company?
Actually, he was Delta Company.
Shit. So Delta Company, 1-9 guy. Now,
right.
Now the cool part about the first interview, there's a whole bunch of cool shit. First of all, Ron, I want you to tell a story about your dad's funeral and your mom laying you on the glass.
You know, God, so much has happened since then, and I'm just going through my mind. But anyway,
we'll get to that. We'll get to all of it. But I just want everybody to hear snippets of the power of a story of a Gold Star son who never met his father, who grew up with living in the specter of this man, this Marine, right, who he knew as his dad, but didn't know. And so it's a beautiful story. And Ron, and the reason I want to do this is that there's all kinds of people that are going to have this experience. Be you a Gold Star child of the Vietnam War, of Desert Storm, of Iraq or Afghanistan. And so I hope this inspires other people to do what Ron has done. So.
Well, and that's exactly why I speak about this is, you know, I felt guilty for years because selfishly in my own, you know, grief of the loss of my father and how you deal with that. And then I realized at one point, about 10 years ago, a little less, that there's a whole other generation of kids right behind me. And so what can I do for those families and talk about my story? But back to your point that you were making is I was doing an interview for, you know, a documentary that's now been released on PBS. And during that interview with my mom, the night before I went to Vietnam for the very first time in 2015, she starts telling me the story. Well, not me, but the interviewee, that my dad's funeral, and that she took me to the open casket, which my father was, you know, killed in Khe Sanh, so he came in under glass, and my mom laid me next to my father because she knew that that was the closest I was ever going to be to my father. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that story, was during that interview, so...
Ron told that story, man. I have tears in my eyes right now just listening to it. I mean, what a wonderful woman your mom was. And again, your mom and dad weren't even married, right?
No, they were engaged right before. I mean, mom got pregnant, and he got engaged with my mom. I got pictures of that. I found too that day where he gave her the ring. And then the plan was, well, not the plan at the time, but he was going to go in, and then he ended up with 1-9, and they fought, like, you know, ferocious battles. I mean, he literally went 3 days in after Operation Buffalo, which I think Bravo was hit pretty hard.
Went
straight into Con Tien and Cam Low, and, I mean, he just battle after battle by the time he got to Khe Sanh at 18 years old. But
for those of you who don't know, when you talk about, so for instance, today it's you know, the Marine Corps is in the process of what they call pivoting to the Pacific. And they're in the process of, you know, looking at, you know, fights that are peer-to-peer, right? And we haven't, I would tell you, we have not fought a peer, which is somebody that will come do to you what you want to do to them, since late in the Vietnam War, specifically in the northern part of Vietnam. And Ron's dad was right in the middle of the most ferocious fighting that the Marine Corps did in that area. When he talks about Con Tien, when he talks about Operation Buffalo, when he talks about Quezon, Cam Lo, Dong Ha, all the places that 1-9 was, Ron's dad right in the middle of it, at 18 years of age. And these young guys were are American heroes. If you read the level of fighting that they got involved with, it's like holy shit reading. So anyway, just a little.
Oh, it's absolutely. I mean, here's just a little snippet. Is you know, when they say fixed bayonets, that is, as I've been described, as you know, one Marine told me, he's like, holy shit, fixed bayonets.
Yeah, that's like
what's going on. And then one night, Bravo took a hit on Hill 64, and all the hills are obviously named after elevation, except for Hill 64, which is named because they could only fit 64 men on that hill.
Holy shit.
It had different names, and they were hit, I forgot what night it was, but it was during the Tet Offensive there in Quezon. And they were hit, and they came through the wire, and it was hand-to-hand. And Delta, my dad's position over on the rock quarry, and my dad was a mortar man, they spent all night. All they could do was deliver mortars until Bravo pushed them all the way back out, you know, and kept the hill, fighting as Marines do. So, you know, these stories are powerful. It's real.
No, you're right. And, you know, when you hear them, you know, talking about, you know, you can imagine at night just hearing that thump, thump, thump as your mortars are shooting for you and guys are calling fires in close and not knowing how this thing's going to work out through the night. And, but again, that was the level of fighting then. And so, you know, I always told, you know, Marines and anybody who's interested, if you want to understand what peer-to-peer warfare is, read about 1967, 1968, 69, in the northern part of I Corps, known as Leatherneck Square, and right smack in the middle of it is 1st Battalion, 9th Marines.
Yeah, my dad was there too.
Yeah, so Ron, so he tells that story, and then Ron, I want you to, so you grew up, and you were the only Gold Star kid that you knew, right? I mean, you didn't know anybody else. And talk about this epiphany of finding other Gold Star kids, going back to making Father's Day cards at the wall, cleaning the wall. Tell everybody about that, because I never heard of anything like that.
Well, I didn't know it existed. You know, I grew up in, it's so funny, I'm back here in Orange County, but this is where I grew up. Then I moved away for several years, but growing up here in Orange County and Northern Orange County and Brea, California, and I will tell you this, I went to, you know, great schools. My mom put me in a great neighborhood, and now I look back at these pictures, I'm the only Mexican kid in any of my classes, right? So I grew up a whole different life here. And a fortunate one at that. So we never spoke about the Vietnam War, my mom and I, nobody in the family. But I always known, really from birth, that I had lost my father in Vietnam. But here's the interesting thing, is I remember 1975, I remember 76, and I remember actually 73 and being really young, right? That's my first recollection of things.
Right.
I had no clue the Vietnam War was still going on. That's how it was past and distance to me, just because you're a kid, you know, and you base that. So over the years, I secretly kind of just wanted to research every possible thing. I watched every documentary. I read every book. So you can imagine it's a lot different at that age versus now where I got information at my fingertips. You know,
right.
I watched the 10,000 Day War. I watched whatever it is. And you're looking for that little glimpse. My dad in there. It's my dad in there. You know, what can I learn? And I really, at the end of it, I really learned nothing. So I'll just fast forward and cover a couple of things. And when my, and it was a lifelong thing. So, you know, my early years in college, I was doing the same thing. I'd go do a book report. I'd pull out books on Vietnam. I knew my dad was in the case at Quezon. I figured he was on base. I didn't know till much later that, no, he was on one of the hills surrounding the base. So, my daughter was born in 1995, And I really remember it was the moment, the instant she was born, and I saw her, and I was completely at peace. I didn't need to know anything else. I needed to be the best father I could be. And that was my plan. And that's how it went until my my ex-wife was pregnant with my son in 1998. And during that time, somebody gone to D.C. and came back with a rubbing from the wall, which I have, you know, 15, 20 of these things over
right.
the years.
Right.
And I took that, and I went, and I grabbed a picture out of my desk of my dad's headstone, and it was the first time I really read Dad. It said 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, Delta Company, 3rd Marine Division. And that's my only snippet, and I got this brand-new computer in 98 with the Internet, and you can imagine what that was like with the dial-up. And through that, I found the Quezon Association. And out of that, I found, I forgot, it was like 11 email addresses for the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, and I sent an email to every single one of them. And what I didn't know was that weekend, they were having a reunion in New Orleans. And so they passed around, because people would just print out the emails and pass it around, and the following week I started getting phone calls. And it's been a while since I've relived this, but I talked to, because we had a lot to cover, so I talked to somebody that was in, the first call I got was somebody that was in infantry training at Pendleton with my dad, and then they met again with the 1-9 in Vietnam. And he'd been to my grandparents' house. Then I met somebody who, like, witnessed my father was there when he was killed and told me that he went up and, you know, to help his friend. And then I talked to Pete Mestis, you know, I'm still very close to him, but Pete saw his friend, Tommy Wallace, T, take a direct rocket hit while he's carrying an ammo can during a work party. He went down. Pete went and ran and grabbed T, threw him on the shoulders, and the mortars were splashing down left and right. He explains it like rain. It just kept raining, and he's all, for some reason, we were never hit. But the concussions kept knocking me down until I'm dragging T by his boot. He gets to the trench line, and I'll tell you about this new part of the story that comes up later, but goes to the trench line. First guy out of the trench is my dad. And so they start carrying him, and then they all take a direct hit. All three of them are hit. And my dad's killed instantly. Pete is seriously injured. And believe it or not, Pete survives and comes home too. And I was totally, and then I spent the week with them the following year in, Mexico. So, my big mistake was trying to drink and keep up with Marines. Which was a complete mistake.
Well, you know what? Honestly, you know, you couldn't go to mental health because, you know, it would compromise you as a man, but you could be a drunk. You could be a drunk or an alcoholic.
You're crazy, right?
Right. And we would accept that. We would accept that culturally in terms of the way we coped with it. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's weird now because, you know, now they're much later in life. We're in their late 60s, early 70s, and so, of course, with health problems and lack of drinking and, you know, have a beer every so often kind of thing is what I got from both of these guys. But back in the day,
in
the 40s, 50s, it's a whole different story. So, so that happens. We spend a week and we're bonded forever, and that ends up with us driving. I flow into Phoenix. We drive down to Mexico. We drive to San Diego. We go to MCRD. We go through watch graduation. We drive up to Southern California. I take them both to my dad's gravesite, and then you know we celebrate their Marine brother, and you know, and then I was at peace. That was it. I didn't need to do anything else. And then a few years later, I was asked to speak. Actually, I take that back. I asked to speak at the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines reunion in Las Vegas, and I was seriously vetted because you want to know what they're going to talk about. You know, right? What has this kid got to say? Because Gold Star's kids just were not, at the time, not a big deal. I mean, we didn't really talk about it. And so,
well, and, again, and the other thing from their perspective is, look, we've been shit on enough by, like, this kid's going to be pissed, and he's going to, what's he going to say? Right.
Right.
Right. No.
Right, exactly. So then I wrote out my speech by, you know, hand, and I saw everything I was going to write. So, and this is the first time where I realized that it is powerful. So I go on first, which is I see a lot. It doesn't happen that way. I tend to be more of a keynote now, but I go on first, and then the keynote comes out. Well, I go on first, and 300 Marines, standing ovation and tears. My mom's there. My stepdad's there. My grandparents are there. My other grandfather's there. And, you know, you bring down the house, and there's nothing you can do, and then the keynote goes on after. He's all, what do I say now?
Yeah, he's screwed.
You know, what do we talk about? Some battle. What do we talk about? You know, what I've always struck me, and again, back to Bravo, the incredible movie, Common Men, Uncommon Valor, which is just still, it resonates with me. And the reason is I go to all these speaking engagements, and I haven't done it for a while, but you hear all these great, you know, battles, and you hear all these high ranks talking, and it's interesting. But what always gets me is that common guy who was eating Wheaties one moment, and next moment he's fighting, you know, serious fighting, you know, and the kind of valor that comes out of nowhere. And so that's how I look to these guys, you know, the 1-1, you know, 1-9, you know, what they fought for. So, anyway, fast forward, and so I'm done. I've spoke, my bucket list is crossed off. Then I had the opportunity to go back for another reunion in 2009 in D.C. with my grandparents and my mom. And that's when I see the wall for the first time with my grandparents. And all of these things, we could talk forever. So, again, I'm at peace. Done.
Why do you keep thinking you're at peace? I'm done. And then this road just gets longer and longer, right? This journey gets incredible. But in your head, like, yeah, like, I'm more, you know, but the thing you didn't talk about is the reaction of those guys when they met you. This is Ronnie's kid, right?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I've seen this very well now. I've got used to it. But, you know, there's a lot of survivor's guilt. You know, what are they going to think? What are they, you know, what's my opinion of the war? What's my opinion of this? What's my opinion of that? And at the end, none of that really matters because it's not about that for me. I was actually inspired by Black Hawk Down when I watched the movie. And at the end, they're really talking about just the sacrifice for a Marine brother. And that's all that really mattered to me. Didn't matter what the war was about or why we were there.
Right.
It mattered that my father was a Marine, as he's been described many times.
Right. To me, when you tell that story about their excitement to meet Ronnie's kid, right, and how much they, like you said, how fired up they were to meet you and that whole experience, I just think it's like, and so I was telling Ronnie, I'm like, you didn't know that you were part of our tribe, did you? And he said, no, man, I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I didn't even know about the tribe. I like, read about the tribe and looked through the window of, like, this is my dad's. And then it was, the first interview was really cool because he talked about, I didn't even know that existed. And then all of a sudden, these guys, they yanked me into the tribe. Yo,
right.
Get in here. You belong to us. And
exactly.
Which is so powerful and so cool that all of a sudden you're a part of this thing that you didn't really know about. I love the story, man. I love your story.
Well, and the way you verbalized it to me is exactly that, being part of the tribe. I think that was, believe it or not, that was just an eye-opener. Like, I already knew, but the way you simply put it was, oh, yeah, that's true. I am. And I operate like that now.
And I think I said, Ronnie, don't you get it?
Yeah.
You belong to us. And he's like, I didn't know, man. I didn't know, but it was warm. And he described, like, it was the warmest, coolest experience that these guys were, like, these guys were violently yanking me into this tribe, and they were so happy to meet me. And who was your dad's best friend? T?
Or, here, we'll get to some a new part of this twist you haven't even heard. But T, my dad's best friend. Yeah. Everybody that was friends with my dad was his best friend, as I find out, even if they didn't know each other, and even if they were in different companies, because that's the kind of guy my dad was. But Pete was his best friend, and T was his best friend. They hung out a lot together. They were in Delta Company. Then I ran across Sammy, who was a sniper and would see my dad and go out in the field for a few days and come back. He knew my father here and at Camp Pendleton. Well, let me bring you up to, you know, how I keep my, obviously my story's not over because it's going to continue. But So we see the wall in 2009. So I let that go. I go about my life. And in 2013, my daughter is finishing her first semester or first year at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And her dorm is approximately three blocks north of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Holy shit.
Three blocks west of the White House. Amazing place. I never put two and two together. But before she went to school, I'm at a barbecue with friends, people I've gone camping with, houseboats, water skiing, drank a lot. And I'm having this conversation. I'm saying, I'm kind of excited about my daughter going to D.C. You know, the Vietnam Memorial's there. My dad's name's there. And she looks at me. She's all, so's my dad. I'm all, what? I've known her for 10 years. We never talked about it. Her father's still missing in action.
Yeah.
So, you know, now we've bonded at a totally different level, and her mom and, you know, her family and everything else. So I let that go, and nothing happened. You know, I don't really talk much or do much on it. And then at the end of the year, I go to pick my daughter up. It's Mother's Day, and they're adding 8 new names to the wall. So I decide, hey, we should go check that out. On the way there, I watch another documentary that I'm inspired by called Cold Star Children. And it starts off with a daughter who lost her father in Vietnam. So I'm interested because I want to hear about this. And this is the red light, you know, the light bulb moment. So that starts, and I'm watching it as a documentary, all informational, because I'm an adult now and I can handle this kind of shit. And next thing they do, a 7-year-old who lost her father in Iraq. I'm done. I can't even function. I've got my blanket over my head, and I'm sobbing underneath this. You know, luckily there's no one sitting next to me. This movie, and I watch it through the whole thing. And I reckon then there's all these people in this organization called Sons and Daughters in Touch. And there's all these people from this organization there as well, and TAPS. And you know, I'm like, oh, maybe someday I'll meet some of these people. And so I get to, you know, so now I've got this in my mind. We go down to the wall. They've got chairs set up, like 200 chairs set up. And my daughter looks at me and says, okay, let's go sit down there. And I look at her, completely serious. And I said, that's not for us. That's for those people over there. And my daughter looked like I was, what are you talking about? Your dad's name is on the wall. But, you know, I could see it all in her eyes.
Right.
And so I don't go sit in the chairs. I don't feel like that's for me.
Right.
I don't know why. I don't feel part of it. I never saw my mom fought for benefits for 3 years for me. You know, we never saw any help. I mean, there's a lot of things. But I stand in the back and I realize all the organizers are there, and I started introducing myself afterwards and, you know, thanking them for it was a fantastic, you know, presentation. And I make somebody cry in 3 minutes, and they take me to introduce me to somebody else, and they're crying in 3 minutes, and they introduce me to somebody else, and they said, you've got to connect with our person in California. So they put me in touch with a person in California, and she puts me in touch with, I didn't know, but the president of Sons and Daughters in Touch, whose father was missing in action for a short period of time. And then recovered, and he started this organization in Southern California in the 90s, and I never knew about him. So I had met the first Gold Star daughter, right, in my adult life, not much earlier, a couple years earlier, and so I'm sitting there, and they said, just tell me about your dad. We know about ours, and so I tell the story, and they told me every Father's Day, every 5 years, we meet in Washington, D.C. So this is 2014 by the time I met him,
right?
I think, and they said, next year we're going to be in D.C., you need to go. So I get to D.C., 2015, we're going to skip ahead, and this is where it all takes off. And I'm done. Remember, I finished everything. This is the new part, all right? So we get to D.C., and because I guess I was really visible right off the bat, and I'm a little aggressive, and well, my dad's a Marine.
So I know, I was going to say, like, hello, man, those are tribal traits.
Right, I don't take, really, I gotta say, I don't take shit. There's a way that, and later, now that I see it, there's a certain way that people need to behave, there's a certain way that the Gold Star son needs to be, there's all these certain things. And so what I tell newcomers in, I'm like, you know what, this is your journey, no one asked you to take your father, no one asked you permission, you behave however you want to behave. Now, if you want to support an organization, yes, you want to be, you know, professional representation of that organization. But as yourself, you be yourself, and I'm going to be myself. So with that said, I guess I made enough waves to the point where I was visible, and I show up in D.C., and I get off the plane, I go straight to the hotel, and I see everybody, and I panic, and I'm like, holy shit, I don't want anybody to know I'm here. So I took off to the wall by myself, had a moment, came back, finally posted late at night, and another Gold Star daughter reached out to me, and her name's Jill Hubbs. She works for PBS out of Florida. And she says, hey, I'm doing some interviews. Do you want to come up tomorrow? And I'm like, sure. So I sit down, and I tell my story to Jill. And remember, I'm all new to this.
Right.
And that's day one. Day two, they're screening the film Gold Star Children, which I saw on the plane previous couple of years ago, right? So then I'm having a moment with the,
filmmaker. That was the head under the blanket moment.
Right. So okay. Now I'm having the moment, a moment with the filmmaker who is a Gold Star daughter, but she's not the one featured in the film. She graciously tells somebody else's story, which I thought was amazing in itself. That, you know, we're caught up in ourselves and in our story. And so I'm talking to her, and I was going to go do another, you know, seminar or something, and somebody starts talking about a trip to Vietnam that's going to happen in 6 months, and they just started planning it. Oh, and by the way, we're going to meet with the enemy and the enemy's sons and daughters because no one's ever done that. And I don't hear that part, really. I'm just going, Vietnam, I'm in. And then the next day is Father's Day, and we wake up at the crack of dawn before, and we have an amazing time watching the monument, and that is the one thing that's on YouTube over the place. It's that particular year you'll see this, but those moments, washing the wall, there's nothing like it, and I'm in the presence now of hundreds of Gold Star sons and daughters, and now I'm in this this other thing. So it happens rapidly for me. That's kind of how everything does. Which brings me to my first trip to Vietnam, which is what we covered. And that was a busy year for me. After the Vietnam trip, guess what I said?
I'm done.
I'm peace. I'm here. There's nothing. What could happen now? I know everybody that was with my father in Vietnam. I know all of his friends before he left. I've heard all first-hand accounts. Everything I wanted to know, I know. And then I realized I know much more than most Gold Star sons and daughters know about their father. They might know somebody who served with them. They might know somebody who was in boot camp with them. Sometimes you'll meet one friend, but never to the depth that I've met. And I'm so fortunate at that point. And then that trip, of course, was amazing. And there's, you know, and we filmed that as well. So in 1 year, I filmed two documentaries. Both were featured on PBS and both available online again. And, you know, obviously changed my life and shaped it. And so that was it. And I was done. You know, until about a month ago.
So now everybody's caught up with the, with what we discovered in pretty much in the first interview. And, right. And Ron, let me tell you, I've had people, you know, talk to me about that interview and say, you know, it's one of those things, like, until you hear something like that, you know, it's not that I wouldn't think about it, because I've seen pictures of it, but I never thought in depth of what that must be like for, you know, somebody who was a Gold Star son or daughter, and all the questions that you would have, and you know, but what a wonderful interview it was. So it's an awesome interview. Go back and listen to it in its entirety, and very, very cool. So now talk to us about, that brings us to, like, not today, but it brings us to before you went on this second trip. What spawns the second trip?
Well, it's just another part of the story. Oh, first, I do need to say something. This is the part I forgot to mention. So about a year ago, there was a post on the BBMF website, The Wall, and, you know, this is Rick Garcia. I knew Ronnie Reyes. You're in my thoughts. By the way he wrote it, I knew he knew him. Right. And I got an alert immediately via email. So I email him the next day. I hear from him. Turns out he lives 20 miles from me where I'm at now. Here's the cool part of the story. He's from Bravo Company 1-9. They are buddies. And you know what you do when you get to battle? Where are you from? California? Me too. Yeah, where at? L.A.? Yeah, I mean, where at? La Puente? Oh, from Pico Rivera. or Montebello, one of those areas, which are literally almost side by side.
Right.
So they become buddies. So my dad has all these pen pals. They're at DMZ. They're sitting back to back. They hadn't had mail in how long. And my dad says, hey, and he, you know, he's got pen pals from school. He's like, hey, you should write her. And he's like, bro, I'm trying to read. Just leave me alone. He's all, and then the picture falls out. He's all, give me that. Long story short, those two, Rosemary and Rick Garcia, have been married for over 50 years.
Wow.
My dad introduced them in Vietnam. They have a family, and they named one of their sons, Ronnie, named after my father. And he was in the trench line with my dad when Tommy was hit. And my dad tried to get out, and Rick grabbed him and says, just wait, it'll all settle down. And he said that my dad did everything to get away from him. Next thing he knows, he sees him at the end of the trench line getting out, and then he witnessed it all. We haven't had that conversation yet. That conversation's coming, and we haven't sat down yet for that. So they renewed their vows for their 50th recently, and invited me and my family, and of course we showed up, and unbeknownst to me, they had me stand up with the rest of their kids. And so again, remember, I think the story's always done, and there's always this other part of it. So that's what's happened, really, since the last time. So let's get to this trip. So,
hey, let me ask you,
I don't know
you a question. It's not easy to live through these moments, right? This journey, it's an incredible journey for you of discovery about your father and how much other guys cared about him. When you go home at night after these experiences, how long does it take for you to kind of get back to normal? Does it take days? Because that's like shaking the tectonic plates of your life. You know, when you sit down and all of a sudden somebody goes there with you, how long does it take you to recover from that?
I don't know. It varies. It just kind of depends. What it does is when I sit down and whatever stress life brings you, I just look at it and go, man, how fortunate am I? I also look at myself as not really my healing anymore, because that'll continue, but I'm a conduit for all of these other people, and that's how I view myself now, so I just make sure I give time. But I get back to it actually rather quickly. I've learned to just kind of put things aside and focus, and that's what I do. A mission needs to get done.
Right.
I'll be 100% focused on it. Then I'll move on. So with that said, I don't know if I've completely ever processed my 2015 trip, and I'm not sure how much I've processed my very recent trip. And they'll come out over time. So I might have a conversation like this, and I'll tap into something that happened in 2015 I forgot about. And that's how it is.
Right.
If it happened all at once, it'd be a basket case. But it happens
slowly.
And I never know when. It's my, to use the word, but it's my PTSD in a different manner. It's my grief that presents itself that way.
No, again, as I go around talking about post-traumatic winning, one of the things you have to tell people is that all of that's okay. There is not a blueprint that everybody walks as we go down this road and deal with it. But, and Ronnie, you're a perfect example of what it is to be a post-traumatic winner, although you would look at me and go, what? Right? You can't medicate yourself to a good place when you live with this kind of trauma. Although medication may be a part of getting to a good place, you can't talk the death of your father into something good. But talking about it may be part of getting there. The only way that you can get to good is to do what Ronnie's done, and that is to give your experience to other people, and in the transformation of their lives, you transform your own. And you are a breathing, walking, living example of facing these things that are difficult, right? But certainly are important to you. And then turning around and by sharing them with others. And what's it like when somebody says, I heard this or saw this, and that was the impetus for me to go on my own? What's it like when you hear that shit?
Well, at first, it always struck me, oh, that's so powerful, and how did that happen? But with technology, things have changed, and I've run into people that have seen one of the two documentaries I'm in, and something out of it. I can, I know somebody recently, they were at a very hard time dealing with their father, being killed in Vietnam, and they saw our movie when it was premiered. My movie was also premiered in D.C., the week after my daughter graduated. So, and we brought five Vietnamese sons and daughters over from Vietnam to meet there and share a moment at the wall. But this daughter was there, and she couldn't even, you know, she couldn't even talk about her dad. She couldn't deal with it. She couldn't do anything. And I got to tell you, the transformation that I've seen since then, with two trips this year to Vietnam, to stand on the very ground, and her father was a Marine. So all the places, Tonkin, she went, DMZ, she's in Leatherneck Square, Quezon, all those areas. And, you know, where her father was killed, and just the transformation that I've seen. And I'm not saying the catalyst, but just being a small part of that, you know, when you see that. And really for the Marines, it have made it easier for them to deal with some of that survivor's guilt. Men that didn't know my father, but have their own survivor skill.
Right.
You know, so, and I could go on and on. I got all sorts of moments that you know, I've seen that come.
Could you have imagined when you started dealing with your own trauma and this thing that was such a big part of your life, although, right, it's like not something we really want to put out in front, and it's kind of something we keep in a down low because I don't really share this with anybody else. Could you imagine that would take you to the place it's taken you?
No. Well, and always being, you know, that I was an only child, as my mom was single until I was 14. Here's another part of the quick story is, the person I knew as my father, not my father, but my mom's boyfriend, he was my father figure. He was also a Vietnam vet. He was killed in a diving accident when I was 7 years old.
Shit.
So my mom and I had now suffered loss twice in 7 years. But, you know, never, and always, so you always look for that thing. What makes me special? What makes me different? What makes me, what's that thing? And I went my whole life, and I did all these different things. I was on the Ventura County Sheriff's Department search and rescue team for 15 years. I was a rescue swimmer. I was an alpine rescue. I flew out of helicopters. Coincidentally, we're Hueys, so I used to like to sit in the gunner's door. I did ski patrol for 2 years. So you can see, when I do something, I jump straight in, and which taught me brotherhood, and I understand Marines a little bit better out of the Sheriff's Department. So I'm always looking for this thing, and it's the thing that makes me is my father and my whole journey that I never talk about. And that's the one thing that, you know, that's become universal. So you're struggling all life trying to find that one thing, and it's been there all along.
How crazy is that? But again, to get it to a place where it now brings happiness to you, where transforming others has changed your life. I mean, honestly, when you tell people that are in that kind of darker place, that, you know, there's a place that exists that you don't know about that I want to help you go to. And that's why I have the coolest job in the world, right? I do that.
Yeah.
I do that, you know, every day. And it's just, but again, that's why I think it's so important that people like you do what you do, because there's people in the blackness and they don't even know that place exists. That in the back of the blackness, in the corner, you know, way to the back of the room, there's a door that leads you to a greater place. But it involves giving of yourself. And you got to learn a little bit, not only about yourself, but about other things. And then as you can begin to touch other people with your story, you'll experience going to that other place. And it's a really cool place. Nobody, again, we all wish we didn't have to go there, that none of these things darkened our doorstep, but life isn't like that. And so you're a walking, breathing, cool as hell example of it. So tell me about now. Okay. So we know what happens. How does this last trip get on your radar, and tell us about the trip?
Okay, so this one I'll kind of go through, and then you can just, you know, stop me when you want to know more.
Trust me.
This is one of those this is one of those unbelievable, how did this ever happen sort of things. So first of all, I had no trip planned for this year. I did cancel my second trip that I was going to take to Vietnam with my Two Sides Project group that I'm a part of, that I went on the initial trip with in December of 2018. I canceled towards the end, and it just didn't feel right. I didn't go, and I actually navigated each one of them to their site remotely from here.
Okay.
And so I let that go, but that would have used up all my vacation and everything else. And so I kind of regretted that I didn't go after the fact. And but everything happens for a reason, and I had more than plenty of vacation at this point, and I meet somebody, and so this is where it gets interesting. So I start dating somebody here in Orange County, not even 5 months ago at this point. And I don't realize at first that she's half Vietnamese. She doesn't look like it. Now I know, but so it turns out that her father was an American serviceman who she does not know. We haven't been able to match through DNA. We're going out on a date, you know, just to get to know each other, and we both find this Vietnam connection. And things blossom quickly. With that, during the 80s, she qualified to come over here as a citizen and bring her mom and her sister with her, and she did. And so her mom was here for, you know, 30-plus years. Well, her mom was very sick, and her mom passed away in the last several months. And her mom's final wish was to be buried back in Vietnam and in the Buddhist tradition, which I was unfamiliar with, and now I'm very familiar with, and I kind of just embraced this whole process. So I say, I'll go if you want me to go. And she's like, absolutely. You know, so I get a ticket and I go with the family and I go back to Vietnam, and I live basically 6 hours south of Saigon in Bac Lu, which I didn't even know existed. And I live with her family. And now I might as well be Vietnamese at this point, right?
Holy shit.
And I could tell you this. I know a lot of people who have gone to Vietnam and have relationships with Vietnamese, and there's a politeness to it, and there's always, you're treated as a guest.
Right.
Even though you're kind of accepted as family, you're still that guest. There's just something that Vietnamese people are like that. And but I crossed the barrier, and it was interesting, and it's been great. But during that trip, and I mean, that's a whole trip in itself, because the Buddhist tradition is actually seven weeks of mourning, and it's actually up to 1 year. Well, it's 1 year, but we get there, and, well, here's the thing. Mom flew us on the airplane from LAX to Hong Kong and from Hong Kong into Saigon, and then the family picked her up in another van, put her in the back, in the casket. They sat in the back. We were in another van, and we drove with Mom for 6 hours to Bac Lu. We get there at sunset, and my girlfriend Stephanie, she's fantastic. I mean, it's just amazing how strong she is. But she says, get ready, it's going to be a lot going on. And she said she wants me to live stream everything. So I do. I've documented all of this. We get there, and there's like 100 people out in front of the series of houses. They own 4 houses and like 6 plots of land. And they pull Mom out right away. They set up in Grandma's house where Stephanie grew up. They put, you know, the casket there. They set everything up, all the offerings for, you know, the Buddhist tradition and incense and everything else. And it starts right there. And for the next 3 days, that goes on. And it's pretty amazing. So later on in the trip, and I'm there for almost 2.5 weeks, we get to Saigon. And I never planned to go see my dad. And we got a couple days left. And I turned to her and I said, you know, my only regret is I really wish we would have had time to go to Quezon. And she says, well, let's do it. And literally in an hour, I'd gone to a travel agency around the corner. I picked it because it had a purple sign, and that's my dad's favorite color and mine. I'm like, I'm just going to go in there. So we booked 2 tickets from Saigon that night to Hue. I got a hotel room booked and paid for, which we didn't end up staying, which is another one. And then I had a driver and a car all day long to go wherever I wanted that following day. And so there I go. We flew away, and that's how. And then we went, and I retraced all my steps, and got there.
This time, though, totally on your time, totally on your agenda.
That's the big deal, because when I went there the first time, first of all, there's so much going on. Culturally, the trip, we were on a schedule. We had so many meetings during the day. We'd leave the hotel around 6:30. We'd get home, we'd get back around 10:30 with meetings and everything all through the day. So when we went to Quezon the first time, we went to the airbase. And I'm like, I just want to get to the spot. Well, the sun's starting to set. So the next thing I know, I'm at my dad's spot, which I have to navigate. And I have to convince people where to go because they don't believe me. But I commandeer all the drivers. I mean, they're going to go where I want them to go. And they
did. You're paying the money, right?
Right. So, and that was on this is on the first trip. Second trip's different. So, and then I'm there, and then I feel like, you know, it was a great experience. I'm not going to shortchange it. It was fantastic. It was what it was supposed to be. But I had this feeling when I left that I wasn't done, that I needed to come back.
Feeling?
And I knew I was, I didn't know when. And then I thought that was going to happen in 2018, and that trip, I might not have been able to make it to my dad's anyway because of the trip, the way it was set up. And so this was on my time and my pace, where I wanted to do how I wanted and to spend where I wanted. And I could spend as much time as I wanted there. And I felt like I spent, oh, and the place where I hiked up to,
yeah,
actually closer to where he was killed, and at the time was still forest canopy. So it would have been a hard hike at sunset, and I decided not to do it, but to stay more where they brought my dad after he was killed, before he was taken out.
Right.
So that's where I stopped the first time. So the second time I actually was able, because it was clear cut, up to the top of the rock quarry, and I was able to go up there where I wanted to go the first time. And you know, and spent time there. So here's the one interesting thing I just thought about probably last weekend is, you know, my father was killed in Vietnam and we brought him here. And then Stephanie's mother died here and we brought her back to Vietnam. And we bookend this trip with a celebration of our parents in totally two different lives. And experiencing the war in totally two different manners. So for me, that's, I mean, truly two sides, you know, on that. And then her story in itself is trying to find out who her father is. And I got to tell you, the abuse and the way that they are treated, Amerasians in Vietnam, not allowed to go to school, spit on, called names, you know, and that was her whole life that they had to suffer. So, you know, it just, very strong person, but so that's kind of it.
How crazy! No, I mean, what a crazy story, though. I mean, if somebody were to say, "Hey, Ronnie, look, I want to show you a glimpse into your future," okay, right? And
yeah,
these are the things that are going to happen. What would you have said, like, all those years ago? You'd have said, "There's no way." That's like, take that to Disney, file it under something,
right?
But it ain't happening.
Yeah. The partnership between my girlfriend and I when we were in Vietnam, first of all, she never traveled all through Vietnam. But obviously I have language on my side. And when you're communicating with somebody who's translating for you, it's different when you're in a relationship, because, you know, people in relationships speak different to each other. They have mannerisms. They have intent.
Right.
You understand everything. So it's a lot easier to convey things to her back and forth. And so she couldn't have done the trip on, you know, without me, and I couldn't have done it without her. So it was just the perfect timing for everything. But interesting note, though, we go to Saigon, and no one speaks Vietnamese to her. They all speak English because they think she's an American tourist. but occasionally people speak Vietnamese to me. So, But anyway, so that's, you know, that's kind of how
now,
I came Vietnam, together.
How did you learn Vietnamese? Because Vietnamese is not an easy language. I mean, you,
no, I don't know it at all. People will, I mean, we go here to a far restaurant and they'll just assume I'm Vietnamese, even though I don't look Vietnamese. It just, I maybe just enough.
What do you say?
I just look at Stephanie, and then she usually, you know, she'll answer in Vietnamese. And there's a couple times where they're totally stunned, like startled. Like, what?
And you look and say, I'm Hispanic. She's Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Right.
What?
It's hilarious. So, well, and that's another thing. It's cultural because, you know, being first generation from a country is a lot different than me being, I don't know, fifth generation here. I don't know. We've been here since it was... we've been in California before it was California. My grandfather was born in East L.A. But it's different, right? So culturally, you know, we'll talk about being Mexican. I'm all, but that's not, I mean, yes, I am, but I, as I told you, I grew up here in Orange County, right?
Right.
It's a different,
culturally,
a little different. You know.
Hey, Orange County wasn't Pico Rivera, just so everybody knows, all right? A little bit different, right?
Yeah, a little bit different, and a great place to grow up, really. You know, I've been very fortunate in life that way, to always be in a great area. And now looking back, what was a burden to me losing my father is I realized later in life as, you know, relatives and friends of my mom's were passing away, and how I was a light in their life, and my mom would put it, and they would put it, like I'd show up, and because there was so much, you know, misery that surrounded us, when I showed up, it was thrilling for people. They really enjoyed it. So I have all these pseudo aunts and uncles, you know, that I grew up with, and always, you know, surrounded by people. And so then I'm fortunate. And I see a lot of Gold Star sons and daughters that live like this happened to them yesterday, and they live in the shadow of their father dying. And it's hard to see sometimes, you know, and they don't have great relationships with their moms.
But isn't it a cool thing, Ron, when you can tell them, hey, look, and this is what I tell people, transforming somebody's life starts with this. Could I talk to you?
Right.
Right?
Right.
And you look
right
at them and say, hey, can I tell you something? There's nothing wrong with you. Everything that you feel is the natural things that you should feel, but I can show you a place that's this wonderful place. And then I want your help when you cross paths with somebody. Will you show them this place too? And I think it's the most wonderful existence. And I mean, and it honors all the best things about your father, right? In that way, your
right.
father is still alive, still touching people through you, and the cool stuff you're doing.
I got to tell you something interesting though. I've taken heat for, you know, my first trip to Vietnam from some Gold Star kids, but also some Vietnam vets, and I had to settle with myself on what is that. You know, it was painful. And then I realized, I'm all, you know what? This is my journey. Like I told you earlier.
Wait a minute. Wait. Why would they give you shit about going to Vietnam?
Because you got to realize, just like anybody, everybody's in different stages of grief. So those kids that
right.
live like their dad died yesterday, and those vets who still, there's a lot that just haven't gotten help or have come to that place. And you've seen it, you know, once they kind of open up that window to, you know, all the brothers, and it's a continual healing process. So I got to be cognizant of where everybody is. It's a tightrope I walk. But I'm cognizant right. of where everybody is in their grief. I can actually feel it and see it when I talk to you. And I'll gauge myself that direction. But I do make no apologies for doing what I do, because this is my journey and my trip, and I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. I'm going to ride this thing out.
But you know? I think what you say is important, because I go through the same thing, right? It's you do it in a respectful way. Understanding
right, right,
that
right,
sometimes
right.
people just aren't ready to go there yet,
right.
but and even though they may not be ready, or sometimes they may get irritated with you, what you've done though is you've planted a seed, and it's not going to get out of their head, and it may take them a few years to naturally come to that and say, you know what, I want to do what he did. I want to, because he's at peace with it, and I'm still I'm not at peace with it. And so I just commend you. And again, but I think it is, when you tread in the world of trauma, you do so respectfully. Because again, I've told somebody, look, I got into a discussion with somebody who wrote a book, and they came on the program, and she made a statement saying that, you know, I really get irritated when people haven't been through anything close to what I've been through, talk about, you know, what they've been through. And I said, well, I think that's wrong. Like, me not being afraid to dial up the awkward factor, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's wrong. I said, so you're the judge. You get to decide what's legit and what's not. And so, and then she came kind of back at me and said something. And I said, well, look, I just think you're wrong. I think you should probably rethink that. The next day, I got the most wonderful email from her saying, I want to thank you for teaching me something. I am nobody to judge. But, you know, so to me, it's so important that we're respectful and you understand the place of hurt, where all this comes from.
Right.
And that that you can gently seed plant, and hopefully those seeds, because this stuff does not leave you, right? This stuff, when you have those experiences, they don't go away, ever. And so when somebody does that, and they show, it's like, why is that Reyes dude... Why does he seem like he's such a good place? And, like, I'm not. Like, what? And you're like, oh, screw that dude, man. He's just, like, faking it like everybody else. But it doesn't leave you. And then maybe someday that changes your behavior. And then it maybe transforms your life, which is the coolest part.
Yeah, we go back to the first movie that I saw, right? You know, that was just in passing. But when I look back, what kind of impact did that have? Oh, here's something interesting. When I, after... Well, it was nice and fun because when I got back from my 2015 trip, which we'd already pre-planned, is my ex-wife had, we separated and we ended up, you know, divorcing, and that was all going on during the same time. As I was, this rise through public speaking and everything I was doing. But I found a list, and I'm a list maker. And I pulled this list out, and I don't know when I wrote the list. It was probably in the late 90s. And the list said, meet my dad's buddies in Vietnam. Speak in front of my dad's group. Visit the Vietnam Memorial. There's some other things, and then the other one was, go to Vietnam. And so I sat there, and I crossed every single one of them off my list. I don't even know what I did with the list. I probably have it somewhere, but I sat there, because when I do find old lists, I will cross them off. I'm like, hey, look, I did these things.
Right.
And so that was there, and I did everything on my list, and more.
So what's next?
You know, to be,
you know, like you keep saying, well, I'm done. But you know, all it does is open other doors and other avenues of discovery. So what's next?
Well, actually, I do have a focus, the direction I think I want to go.
Well, there's a shocker.
Well, at first I thought I want to really be more, involved with the MIA mission, MIA POW mission. But they got a great group of people and Gold Star kids that are working on that and are very committed to it. And so I wanted to do whatever I could. And then, really, this plight of the Amerasians, they don't have the same connection. So I deal with, you know, I obviously know how to deal with military units. I know how to do research. I know how to talk. I know how to get through that. But what if that English is not your first language? Your dad's a military serviceman, and your first language is Vietnamese. It doesn't come across, you know. So how do you bridge that gap? So I want to be able to help bridge that gap and be involved. And to what extent, I don't know. But, you know, the first one is obviously very personal, is we'll continue with the DNA match and see where we go with connecting her with her dad. Here's an interesting thing that happened. So when I get to Saigon or when I get to Vietnam, you want to know what's really cool? Oh. My Facebook lights up. Rod, you're in Vietnam? Are you going to be in Hanoi? Are you going to be in Dong Ha? Are you going to be in Saigon?
Get out.
Well, we want to see you. We want to see you. We want to see you. These are my Vietnamese brothers and sisters.
So this is the GPS function of Facebook, right?
Right.
Intervening in your life.
Exactly. Telling me what's up. So I get to Saigon, and I'm invited, and they're all, we just so happen having a meeting with brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, tomorrow. And By the way, no one had connected these sons and daughters prior to our visit. We were the first ones to bring them out in public. And because of our visit in 2015, they have found their own organization that runs very similar to ours and get together. Well, it was Martyrs Day, which is their Memorial Day. I didn't know that. They invited me to be a guest to sit with them, and then they honored me and my father as they're telling everybody else's stories while I was right there in Saigon. And then I was, you know, are you going to come up to Hanoi? So it was great to have that kind of connection when I get to Vietnam. And I'm to the point now, I'll go to Vietnam in a whim, and I'm willing to go there with no travel plans because I can get around anywhere in the country. The mystery and the scariness of the country is gone. It's a different place for me now.
How crazy is that, man? How crazy is that? But again, that's a gift, though, that you keep giving to other people, Ron. And you perfectly illustrate that you can only get it to good if you give, right?
I think it's the secret. It's the secret that people just don't realize. And I got to go back to my early grief. I was in my grief, in my journey, in my story. My dad's important. This is important. This is important. And I do hear that amongst other kids, you know.
Right.
Their dad is the most important story. Well, it is to them. But I got to look at it in an expanded view and the big cog and how things run. And when I started turning that and realizing that I could give back, and then the more I give, the more I get. I mean, I'm getting back 10 times what I'm giving.
Dude, people are going to think we scripted this shit, all right? Because this is, it's the truth, man. It is the way it works. And to see you doing it and your story is such a wonderful story because it comes from out of such a place of hurt, right, and not knowing, and then to discover this tribe that loves you that you don't even know about, to then discover another tribe of children like you.
Well, I'll tell you,
and all these experiences to take your family, and now to take your girl with you. I mean, it's just the story. Yeah. But again, to me, the point of the point of the point of the point is this. You know, you have to. The first thing we all fight is ignorance. We don't know. And then Ron got out there and discovered the things that were true and began to deal with them. And then he began to giving that truth combined with his own experience to others. And it's in that giving that transforms others and ourselves. And it's just, it's the coolest place in the world, man. I couldn't be more happy for you, man.
Well, thanks. Oh, and I want to give, not that you lift the veil on everything, but the way that you operate in case no one knows. So, we go to Vietnam, we're Facebook friends, and I get a message from you, and this is how things work with Mac. Hey, want to come on the show, talk about Vietnam? And that's it. Because I know what really is next is, you don't want to ask me any questions or know anything until I'm on air. And then we can go through this very organic, you know, dialogue. And I really appreciate that, you know, and it's a comfort level, you know when I'm going to come on. I'm like, oh, I'm going to talk with friends and my tribe, and that's it. I turned my tribe on to you, which is, you know, part of the tribe. So the 1-9, Richard Garcia, which is not the same Rick Garcia, he's the former president of the 1-9 Association. He lives here locally in Orange County. And I got to tell you, what this man does for the Marines, and he will travel anywhere for a Marine and help. And we do a memorial hike up behind Camp Horno, and we go up to Memorial Hill where all the crosses are, the 1-1's up there, and we've erected our cross, the 1-9. And I'll connect you, but this is, you know, an amazing man, and he reached out to me when I said I was going to do this, and he went through your podcast, and, you know,
you need to introduce me to him, and first of all, you and I need to physically meet, so it would be cool if the three of us could go out to dinner.
And absolutely.
I would love to have him on because, one, I would love to, you know, further document what they did in 1967, 68, and 69. And I'd love to do that. And then I'd love to tell out the story because I know guys who were in 3-9. I know a guy by the name of Jack Riley who was in 3-9. And Jack Riley is one of my heroes. And Jack Riley came home, and he got a call from the VA. Were you in Vietnam in 1968? Yeah. You need to come in. Here's a map of something called Agent Orange. Where were you? Where were you when you were in Vietnam? And like the heaviest concentrations of Agent Orange,
right,
those guys were in. And so, you know, do your kids have any problems? Well, both my boys have a form of spina bifida. And the doctor looked at me and said, this is why. The only thing Jack Riley has ever done is give of himself to Marines. And he started writing to different phone companies in states asking for a DOS disk of their directories so he could look up.
My God.
Exactly. This is back in the, you know, back, you know, first generation computers, you know, mid to late 80s. They're trying to organize reunions. They're trying to track down guys. You know, how do we get a hold of so-and-so? How do we get a hold of so-and-so? And because we all talk shit about where we're from, right, we would know, well, you know, Ronnie Reyes, he's from L.A. Okay, well,
right,
you know how many Ronnie Reyeses are in L.A.? I don't know if you all have ever looked at the name Reyes in the phone book, but you're going to find more than one. I'm going to tell you that. So, but this is the kind of shit he did. And now, and so he got them together when it wasn't cool for Vietnam veterans to get together. And he bound them together. Well, now what is he doing? He's tending to them in death, making sure that they know that, hey, man,
right,
if your family needs anything, right, we will take care of your family. And there's these incredible men, and he sounds like one of those guys.
Yeah, it's his mission. Here's I just want to touch on Agent Orange real quickly here. So something I learned when I was in Vietnam on my first trip. Now, I got to speak with the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam at the time and the head of the MIA POW project at the time that was in Vietnam, which none of this is in the film, but it's amazing. Oh, and I spoke to the political chief at the U.S. consulate general when I was in Vietnam.
Holy shit, man. You get around, man. Well done, man. Well played.
Right? So... But we're talking about Agent Orange. And so Agent Orange is one concentration of dioxin. And so there's Agent White, Agent Blue, Agent Purple, Agent Orange, right? So Agent Orange is by far the most popular. Get this. Agent Purple is 10 times the concentration of Agent Orange. Agent Purple was used for rodent control around military bases. It was hand sprayed by men for rodent control. So like Da Nang would be one of those bases, and it requires Superfund cleanup. But I don't think, you know, people hear Agent Orange, but they don't realize there's different concentrations of that mixture and how they may not think they were in the Agent Orange area, but they might as well be right with the, you know, Agent Purple at 10 times the concentration. So that was an eye opener for me.
Which was one of the gifts that we left to the people of Vietnam.
Absolutely.
Which has its own story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, you go there and then there's the government version of everything too. So,
right.
You know, so there's but the people are different. You know, 70% of the population wasn't even born during the conflict. And when you talked about it, again, even talking to my girlfriend, the war has very little significance or meaning when we talk about it because life was life. The French were there, then we were there, then they fought the Cambodians, and they're fighting hunger, and then, you know, we're just a blip on the screen. Although it, you know, had huge impact. So it's just been interesting to see the two ways how we hold it in a different regard. So back to that martyr thing. So when I took my girlfriend to that, she's like, she didn't know what to say because now she had those feelings that we had as American kids. What are they going to think? My dad, you know, might have dropped bombs. My dad might have fought. My dad might have killed, you know, them. And it was her first connection with her dad being military. And then I took her to Quezon, and she saw C-130, and for some reason she had a connection. And never had any of this during her life. So, you know, in that some small way, we, like you said, you plant a seed. You know, maybe she talks to her brothers or sisters about it.
Well, you know, and especially that, I mean, she doesn't have an answer, right? She doesn't have an identity.
No.
She has nothing. She has nothing.
No.
And so,
we know this. She's half Irish. We know that part.
Oh, so she's gifted. We love that.
Yeah, well,
how do you?
I said, you should have known. You drink whiskey like an Irishman?
whoa, hold on. So how did she know she's Irish?
DNA.
Oh, really?
Right. So we know he's an American, right? And then the Irish roots come through the DNA, so here you go. But it's, and she didn't know that. She knows nothing about Irish.
Right.
Well, you like whiskey. You know any of your friends like whiskey?
How
so, but you know, that's, so we'll start uncovering some things the best we can. And that's a story. I don't know we ever get an answer. I'm fortunate. I got all my answers, but.
Well, you keep saying that, and then you get more answers. Here's an email. I'm sitting here listening to this interview and just thinking to myself, holy shit. First of all, congratulations to Ron and from all of us Marines. So proud of the courage that you've displayed as you've gone through this. So proud of the selflessness that you've displayed as you've gone through this. You are truly of our tribe. Your father is looking down on you and is button-popping proud, as we say. So well done, Marine. Keep up the great work. Keep inspiring other people. And I don't know that there's a higher compliment that Mac gives on this program than by calling somebody a post-traumatic winner. It doesn't happen often, as most of us are still deep in the struggle, but you are certainly that, Ron. Congratulations, well done, Semper Fidelis. Keep giving, keep changing lives. I think that's one thing that this program has taught us, that by continuing to give, continuing to change lives, all you do is make your life better. Well done, brother. So proud of you.
Well,
boom!
Thank you. I
all right, we'll end on that. Holy shit, man.
Well, thanks for having me on again. It's always a privilege, an honor.
No, let me ask you one question before I let you go.
Yeah, sure.
So if somebody's listening to this that has something that they haven't unpacked, could be that you're a Gold Star kid, right? Could be that you're a veteran and there's a place that you haven't gone yet. Because you even alluded to who's the guy who was in the trench when your dad was killed?
Rick Garcia.
You haven't gone there yet with Rick?
No.
Right?
No, but we spend a lot of time together. We've had beers together, but we haven't had that moment
that
yet.
Conversation. So the right. So what advice would you give people that are looking at this daunting thing in their life, not sure if they should confront it or not? What advice do you give?
Do the most difficult thing first. Take a step. Because then you're just one step closer. And sometimes that's what it is. Sometimes it's so minor. Okay, I'm going to look this up, or I want to do that. But these things happen at incrementally. You do a little bit, it's a little adjustment. Then you make another little adjustment. Before you know it, you're down this road. I couldn't have not tackled this the way it is. It was a small, I talked to that person. Then I talked to that person. Wait. That person could help that person, so then I connect people, and then this network starts forming, and it forms a life. But I say, don't be afraid of whatever that is. It may be scary, but you got to take a step. You know, and also, I mean, for me, I'm open to find out whatever that answer is, good or bad. And I've had some very, very candid conversations at reunions, because I'm treated, as you said, I'm part of the tribe. I feel it. But they have conversations with me just like I'm my father. So, of course, I hear details that are never going to be public.
Right.
But that's part of it. But I embrace that because it's war. And that's just what happened, and it's done. You know, where do we go from here?
His name is Ronnie Reyes. Is it Ronnie Reyes Jr.?
No, it's actually, I'm not a junior, but I am named after my father. And my son is not a junior, but he's named after my father as well. Last two things is you can find both films online through PBS online. The first one is They Were Our Fathers. It's about sons and daughters in touch. Father's Day every 5 years. The second one I'm very proud of, is The Two Sides Project, also on PBS. Interesting thing. Remember Jill Hubs, who interviewed me for the first trip?
Yes.
I mean, for the first documentary about Gold Star Sons and Daughters. Yeah. She is now part of the Two Sides family, and she went back to Vietnam with our group last year. That's her second time. And she also put the whole deal together with PBS for the Two Sides Project film. So interesting how we all connected.
Will you connect me to her? I'd love to interview. I'd love to have her on and tell that story.
Oh, absolutely. And her and Margo is part of the Two Sides Project, who spearheaded this entire thing again. And her fathers, both of their fathers, are missing in action, by the way.
That's brutal. So the documentaries. I'll put links into this post, but one is called "They Were Our Fathers," and the second one is called
the Two Sides Project. Right.
All right. His name is Ronnie Reyes. Trust me, you haven't heard the last of him on All Marine Radio. All right, so you got to introduce me to the 1-9 guy, and we got to go out to dinner.
Done. Like I said, he's local. He probably already texted me while I'm sitting here. So.
Okay. So do not screw that up, man. Do not screw that up, or I'll be pissed and start talking shit about you right here on my show. Right? Let me just tell you, I'm so proud that I'm so happy that our paths have crossed. My heart is happy because you are an example for a culture that deals with traumatic pain into a place that you can go if you're not afraid to face the truth, as Admiral Stockdale talked about when he was in the Hanoi Hilton. If you will look at the unvarnished truth, and then you will turn around and share that your story combined with the truth with other people, you will transform other people. And in that transformation, you continue to transform yourself. And you are a great example of it, man. And I am so happy for you. I'm so happy for the people that will listen to this who no doubt deal with something in their life that they don't really want to. And you're a great example of what it is to get after it, to give, and to transform your life. So well done, man. Well done.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And we'll be in touch, and we'll all get together here soon.
All right, Ron. Thanks for the visit.
Thanks, man.
Have a great
day, man. Bye-bye.
That is Ronnie Reyes, -2. And how about that for an awesome story? Huh? Are you kidding me? I love that story. I love that story. And you know what? He keeps thinking it's going to end, but it keeps getting better. Like, what the hell? That'll do it on a Monday. Yeah, like my happy trip, man, from the weekend just continues. If you missed the first hour, this past weekend I went back to my home in Sacramento, California, and just had an awesome time. I stayed with the closest thing I have to a brother, and that's my cousin Tom. Just had a great time. And then on Saturday, the reason for my trip was my high school class, my graduating class, the class of 1957, that was the year I was born, the class of 1976, the centennial class of Christian Brothers High School, got together. It wasn't one of our official reunions, right? It's just, there's a group of dudes that said, we need to do this more often. We need to just get together. Because it's good for us. And it was all boys Catholic high school. Right? And we had all known each other. A lot of us had known each other since the fifth grade when we started playing sports and against our schools played each other. Yeah, in no shit sports, man. And it was important who won back then. We didn't play to participate, man. We played to kick your ass. We played to kick your ass. And that's how we grew up. And so I had a chance to go, and it was just a wonderful experience, wonderful weekend. And they're awesome guys, and like most groups, there's guys in various stages. Some of us are healthier than others. Some of us are happier than others. But when we're together, it's the warmest place on earth. And so so I talk about that in the first half hour. And so you'll hear that. The and then, just concluded, is an absolutely fantastic interview with a guy who I read about and then got in touch with via Facebook, who came on the program, I want to say over a year ago, and told this story about what it was to be a Gold Star kid. And took me to a place that I didn't know existed, because I'd never, you know, walked in his moccasin. And I, you know, in the first part of the interview, Ron talks about some of the things that, you know, literally froze me as he said that. You know, I have this visual image of, you know, his father, 18 years old, not married to his mother. They were engaged. And his mother placing an infant baby on glass that covered a Marine who'd killed in action in the vicinity of Khe Sanh on the glass of his casket, knowing that that was as close as he would ever be to his father. And he tells a story about just what a wonderful woman his mother is and how she raised him, and then this whole process of discovery and how he shares it and touches other people. So you'll hear that. So trust me, one of the coolest interviews I've ever done on All Marine Radio, and today was even better. So Ronnie Reyes, man, he's the shit. He's the shit. And to all the Marines of 1-9 that embraced them and changed Ronnie's life, well done. Well done, Devil Dogs. Well done. That'll do it. So, have a great day. I kind of feel that I should end the program today with the song that I played that is symbolic of my high school class. It's the song that reminds me of being with them when we used to go to Mass on Fridays. And this is it. So we'll end on this. So we used to start every class at Christian Brothers High School with a saying that happens in Christian Brothers classes all over the world, because they were an order that believed in education for everybody, which normally took their schools into tougher parts of the city. And, yeah, my high school wasn't a high-end Catholic, all-white high school. It wasn't. That's not the way the Christian Brothers do it. The high school was in the one of the poorer parts of Sacramento. And our high school was pretty diverse and very, very Hispanic. Again, in a private school, and they had, you know, a pretty large Hispanic attendance in the 70s. Yeah, and that's how the Christian Brothers did it. And so it was a really cool place. Honestly, it was a cool place. We had great sports teams. I said in the first hour, this was before the era of sensitivity training, right? You went to an all-boy Catholic high school? Trust me, man. You rolled around town. You got called a fag. You know, you got called everything when you were playing. But we were good. And we were like, oh, really? All right, watch this. And we annihilated them. So, but this song, and I've had this MP3 for a while, whether I've been in Iraq or Afghanistan, it always takes me back to listening to this song in Mass, singing it when we went to Mass together as our entire class, our entire school, about 1,000, I think, would go to Mass with our teachers, and it was just always a cool feeling. And so dedicated to all my friends who I spent the weekend with. God bless you all. May he hold you in the palm of his hand and keep that hand close to his heart.
The road is long.
Somebody just texted me, Max, who the hell is that? That's the Hollies. Come on, man. Don't you know your music from the 60s? From the 60s and the 70s? Yeah, he's my brother. So, and they are definitely that. I'm blessed in my life. And I'm great friends. And like I said, some of the guys that were there, I've been friends with for 56 years of my 61-year life. I mean, how about that shit? And it's just wonderful seeing them. So I tell you that hoping to inspire you to reconnect with those people, and you don't know whose life you're going to save, by bringing them maybe out of an isolation. Now, I'll tell you a story. When we went back, I want to say it was the first, it might have been our 25-year reunion. And a friend of mine named Mario Rodriguez, who was there on Saturday, Mario's got a son in the Army. And I've known Mario since I was 5 years old. Went to school with him my whole life. But I mean, he had a son that got in some trouble and is struggling with it. And so, I'm talking to friends. I said, "Where's Mario? Is he coming?" And they're like, "No, he's not coming. He doesn't go out much anymore." And I said, "Well, fuck that." I said, "You got his number?" And my friend Jay poses, right? Jay the troublemaker. Jay says, "Yeah, I got his." I said, "Well, call him." So we're at the reunion and it's late and we're getting ready to leave and I call and Mario answers the phone. And I said, "Mario, what are you doing?" I said, "This is Mike McNamara." And he goes, "What is going on, man?" I said, "Why aren't you here?" He goes, "Oh, you know, I don't really." I said, "Hey, man, you either come, right, or I'm coming to your house. We're coming to your house. And if you lock the door, I will door kick it, okay? I know how to do that shit." And he's like, "No, you have to do that." I said, "Well, what's it going to be?" He said, "Well, I'm not going to be able to get there in time." I said, "All right." I said, "Where can we meet?" And so Mario, we met him, at, I don't know, midnight, and had and hung out to like, I don't know, 2 in the morning talking shit and laughing. And, you know, and again, I don't know that changed Mario's life. I know it reconnected him to me and other friends that he has who think the world of him. And those relationships are important. And so I play that song, I relay this story in the hopes that, you know, those people that had such a huge part in your life, you never know who's struggling. So stick your hand out and save somebody's life. Anyway, my thanks to Ronnie Reyes for coming on today and telling just an awesome story about the same thing. So that'll do it on this Monday. All Marine Radio is officially over and out.